Hi, folks. Bob Mayne here with another episode of your weekly Handgun World podcast, episode 284, to be exact. I'm Bob Mayne, your host. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. This week, I am going to answer a long-requested topic, and that is on reloading ammo. I've received a lot of emails and voicemails from listeners asking me to do a show on reloading ammo. The reason I haven't done it is because I don't reload, and so I don't like to talk about things on this show that I haven't done or experienced. I don't think that's fair to you, the listener. However, I do have a couple of loyal listeners who are experienced ammo reloaders, and both of them listen to the show, Mexican Joe, and also Mark the Noof, and you'll understand why he's called Mark the Noof when you listen to the interview. Mark has been through several of our training classes before, and so I've seen him shoot. He's pretty good, and he brings his wife occasionally. I think he's signed up. Yeah, in fact, he is signed up for the upcoming Houston class that Ben and I are doing, which I'll be talking a little bit about later. But these guys talk about reloading ammo, and it's pretty good stuff. If you are an experienced reloader, you might pick up some one or two ideas. If you're just getting started in reloading, you're going to find this to be quite valuable. And even if you don't care about reloading, you need to listen to this anyway, because it's a great education on bullets and primers and cases and powder and actually how ammunition actually works. As a concealed carrier or as a firearms enthusiast, or even if you're a competition shooter, you need to know how ammunition is put together. You need to know how it works so you can be more educated on the subject. So Joe and Mark do a great job here of giving you some good information that's pretty easy to understand. You know what I like about this is these guys didn't get too technical. They got technical enough to be informative, but they didn't start running away with all kinds of technicalities that are boring. These guys kept it very interesting and very informative. So, Joe and Mark, thank you very much for helping me out with this subject. So here you go. Joe and Mark on reloading ammo.
All right, Mexican Joe here, back with another interview to try to help Bob out. I've got Mark on the line here, and we're going to go over some reloading. How you doing today, Mark?
I've managed to pull through, I do believe.
Okay, and your name is it Mark the Noof?
Mark the Noof, yep.
Okay, and I've been wondering this. What is the Noof?
The Noof, you're basically a Noof or a Noofie or a Newfoundlander or somebody from Newfoundland, Canada.
Oh, okay, okay.
That's originally where I'm from.
Okay, I've always wondered that, and I had never gotten a chance to ask.
Yep.
Okay, now Mark's going to go into some details about reloading. Me and Mark have kind of discussed this, and this is just basics of what reloading is and how it works for you and saves you money and everything else and helps you out with your reloading. We're not going to get real deep in the technicals because somebody's going to try to tear it apart. One of the comments that right off the bat that I want to tell people, and Mark, I think that you'll agree to this, is safety.
Yeah.
I mean, you're dealing with gunpowder that's open powder, primers that are reactive, all that kind of stuff. This is not something you just run out and throw a teaspoon of this in or a little bit of that in. It's all precise measurements.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff going on here. At the end of the day, you're making a controlled explosion.
Right.
So keep that in mind when, you know, if you don't, you know, stuff blows up. You should always have your eyes covered and your hands protected. I mean, you're dealing with nasty metals sometimes. I mean, there's lead and things like that. So right at the very beginning, if you're going to be doing any sort of work with this stuff, make sure that, you know, you're covered. I mean, that's really what we're talking about. Cover your eyes. Cover your hands, gloves, even those silly little, was it the mechanics gloves?
Right.
I mean, if a primer isn't going to hurt you really, but I mean, if it goes off, it goes off. It'll give you a burn. And, you know, having gloves on helps.
Yeah. Yep, I agree. I mean, I think when I was doing it back in the day, safety wasn't as big an issue, and we didn't wear safety glasses, but now we do, and now I wear them all the time when I'm doing stuff.
Yeah, and it's, you know, there's all kinds of things that, you know, you shouldn't mix and shouldn't be around. It's you know, like try to keep the primer separate from the powder, and, you know, obviously keep hot stuff away. Don't be doing this in front of the campfire if you can help it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just a lot of it's common sense. And, you know, I don't know about you, Joe, but I got a fire extinguisher on each end of the room here, just in case.
Yeah, yeah, I'm a big fan of fire extinguishers. It's the same thing as a gun, you know. Yes, my fire extinguisher is loaded.
Yeah.
Now, just to kind of, to try to start things, I think, in the beginning, I mean, you know, tell me how you feel. I think in the beginning, you should start off with getting the manuals, because you don't pull these loads and these measurements and all this stuff just out of a hat. You work through 2 to 3 different books. I know that when I started with a Hornady book and then got a Sierra book, and I don't remember what the third one was I got, but you could do run a comparison load with different powders, primers, and bullets for what you're doing.
Yeah. There's really, I mean, a lot of people swear by the Lee book, and I kind of like, I think the Lee book was actually one of the last ones I bought, and it's actually quite good. And what you do is, like you say, you do a comparison. It might be that, you know, one says 5 grains, the other one says 4.8, the other one says 5.2. Okay, well, let's start with 5. You know, that sort of thing. And it may be actually that some of the books will give you loads for a specific weight of bullet using a specific powder that the other book won't have.
Right.
So not only that, but it could be that, you know, let's say, I'm just giving an example here, let's say the new Hornady flex-tip bullets, right? Guaranteed Hornady will probably have them in their loading manuals.
Right, right.
But there's a chance that the other loading manuals won't. So not only do you get a good, you know, number of different loads with different charges and different bullets and things like that, but you also get the specific hardware being listed. So it's a good idea. Not only does it kind of expand your knowledge and your database, but it gives you a good idea if you're doing it right.
Right. Now, when I got my second book, like I said, I think I started out with a Hornady, and I think I got the Sierra after that. And yeah. I basically, in the beginning of the book, it actually goes through the how to reload and all of that. And I read in the second book, and even though it was generally the same, it was actually put out there a little different.
Yeah.
So that was kind of nice, and it explained a couple of things. And again, like you had said, some of the difference in some of the books isn't just the bullets. Some books are, when you get into a certain, whether it be 45 or 38 or 357 or whatever, they're specifying a certain primer for this entire set of data.
Yeah, there's, I mean, a good example of that is for the rifle with the M1 Garand. You have to have limits to what you're going to throw that bullet at. And I mean, velocity-wise and pressure-wise. And I do believe it's the Hornady book actually has a complete section on loading for the Garand. And I don't think the others do.
And is that because the bullet will spin itself apart if it gets too hot?
No, what happens is if you use a powder that's too slow and you do pressure spikes in it, you can actually get enough pressure coming through the piston rod system to bend the operating rod and ruin your gun.
Okay.
So, and that applies to a certain extent to the M1A as well. So, again, that is not something I've seen in any other book, and it just so happens that the Hornady book was the second one I bought. I was like, huh, look at that. I didn't know. Because up until that point, I was just taking it, you know, from people on the all-knowing internet that's how you do it.
Right.
Now I actually have, you know, written information from Hornady using their bullets, using typical charges and primers and things like that, so I have backup. And that's what it's all about, really, Joe. It's about backing up what you're doing.
Right. Now, something that you just mentioned there that I think that a lot of people who haven't ever reloaded don't understand is you said a slow-burning powder. When we say slow-burning powder in reloading, we're not talking about really slow. We're talking about something that burns slower than a fast-burning powder, but it's still microseconds.
Right.
But when you get when you're running a slower-burning powder, you end up with more pressure.
Right.
It burns slower, so it gains more pressure while in the barrel and in the casing and takes off. A faster burning powder would give you a lighter load, theoretically. I know that from my experience, I used to run 357, and my typical high pressure load was using IMR 4227, which is a grain, or like, it looks like sand, and it was a very high pressure load. But when I used the Desert Eagle, I had to have that. Now when I used the 357 revolver, I would use 700X, high score 700X, which is actually a shotgun powder, but they do have load data for it, and it gave me some really light 357 loads that were really easy to manage.
And that's the thing about reloading, Joe, is that, you know, when you ignore the hobby side of it as such, when you ignore, you know, and there is cost savings to it, you just end up shooting a whole bunch more because, well, you can do it with a bandit because you're reloading, right?
But yeah.
You can tweak and customize to suit whatever you're doing. And that, to me, is one of the big advantages. You can go in and you can make, you know, for your 1911, you can make a low recoil plinking practice load. Well, you can also make a thumper that is the equivalent of a plus P that's, you know, pushing the better part of 1,000 feet per second to match your defensive loads. If you want to practice with defensive loads but not add a buck of bullet, you know?
Right, and right there you said something about, you know, you talked about the cost savings, is that if I'm running a powder and I'm using 7 grains of powder or 12 grains, whatever, and another load's running 14 grains, now grains is different than grams, it really gets really in-depth, it's very light, I mean it's like a cigarette ash, probably weighs 10 grains.
It's 7,000 grains per pound, I think is what it is.
Right. So when it comes into the cost savings, when we're talking about that, if you're buying a can of powder, I used to buy it in by the pound, 1 pound at a time, because I wasn't doing that much. But if I'm only using 10 grains per bullet for this specific load, but on another load I'm using 30 grains, I'm using more powder when I'm using 30 grains. So then you start comparing price per powder, and again, that's where your cost savings comes in.
Right.
Or where it starts.
And it's like, you know what? Again, I don't know about you, Joe, but I didn't save a lot because, honestly, I shoot 45 with a bandit now. I just don't care. I'll go blow through 200 rounds in a session and it won't even cause me to hiccup because, you know, it's cheap. Whereas before, I mean, I would go out and I'd buy a 50-pack 45 and it'd be about $30. I was like, well, you know, I'm just going to shoot 50 with it.
Well, yeah, well, and see, what happens is, you know, you start out with the cost savings, and I totally agree with that, but what ends up happening is your cost actually ends up becoming the same, but you shoot three times as much.
Yeah.
So, okay, so basically, I mean, that's how I justified it with my ex-wife was, you know, well, you know, I'm saving money, and I'm just spending time, I'm down here in the shop, I'm okay, I'm not doing anything, and then after a while, she's like, well, you're at the range a lot. Was because as soon as I get a load worked up and I'd get it zeroed, then I'd be shooting that load quite a bit more. I mean, I'd go out and shoot, 200-300 rounds in a session, or before it'd be like a box, maybe two. So, yeah.
I fortunately, my wife likes to go to the range with me, and actually, we've done some training with Bob, and ILO 38 Special for her, and I mean, she shoots the snot out of that little revolver that I've got because basically she's almost doing it for free because I'm supplying everything.
Right.
And so, I mean, she went to that pistol course that we did with Bob. And I'll tell you what, she was ringing steel better than most people there because guess what? She shot the living guts out of that revolver because she was shooting for free almost.
Yeah, well, and again, the more you shoot, the better you shoot and the better you get at it.
Yeah. That was just one major point there. It's not only is it a hobby and things like that, but there is a cost savings to a certain point, and then the cost savings, if they don't come up, it's because you're shooting more, which is not a bad thing either.
Right. Well, you're shooting 2 to 3 times as much for the same price, so it's a moot point.
Yeah.
One little snippet I like to throw in whenever I talk to people about reloads is reloads are fine. They're for practice. They're for training. Whether you're using a light load or a heavy load or whatever you're using, never, ever, ever carry reloads in a carry gun when you're on the street.
Well, unless you want to bait a lawyer.
Right, because that's an old Masada Yub thing that I learned back in the early 90s was... Yeah. Not only did you have to, you know, should something happen and you have to pull out your weapon and you have to shoot somebody, not only did you shoot them with this, you know, big evil black gun or whatever it is and it, you know, and it had a bullet in it, you had to make special killer bullets.
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah, you're going to hang yourself if you do it. I mean, I tell people, I was like, yeah, defensive ammo is $1 a bullet, theoretically. You know, when you're buying the 45 or even the 9mm, and they're only in 20, 25-round boxes, and you're going to pay $1 a bullet, but you don't practice with them all that much. You use your practice ammo for that. You use all your dumb full metal jackets and whatever for training. But carry a defensive load.
Now, in the meantime, like I said earlier, I used to carry Golden Sabers, and I came to find out that you could actually buy the Golden Saber bullet. So I actually went out and bought like a box of 500 of those things and started working up a load to try and get the velocity the same as what you get with the regular Golden Saber loads. Now, I came close. I didn't get right there exactly, but I came within like 50 feet per second. So technically, I can practice with my defensive load technically because it's close enough.
Right.
And guess what? It's a whole lot less than a buck a bullet.
Yeah. Well, and another point there is something I found out was that not only are you making your rounds for cheaper than factory price, you can usually beat a factory load as far as grouping.
Guaranteed.
I mean, when I was doing it with a revolver, I was doing it fully rested and all that just to try to find, because when I'm trying to zero, and we'll go into this in a minute, how to zero a load, but I would take factory ammo and I could get a 1.5-inch group with a 357 revolver, 6-inch barrel, but when I'm doing it, you know, and I get a load that I've made, because the powder is within a tenth to 2/10 of a grain every single round, it just, I can cut the groups in half.
Yeah, another part about reloading is kind of like the pride in I made this. Just like if you know, a lot of people go out and they buy a gun and they shoot it and they say, oh, I've got, you know, 1,000 rounds of this that I've never cleaned and type thing. Well, I'm kind of embarrassed by that. I clean my guns every time I shoot them because I have a certain amount of pride in what I do. The same thing with the ammunition. It's more consistent. Looks just as pretty, if not prettier, because it's nice shiny brass that I made. And I can guarantee that, well, like you say, when you shoot these things, you're probably, let's say you were going for 850 feet per second. Guaranteed you're going to be there plus or minus, you know, 10%. Guaranteed, maybe even less, depending on the consistency of the casings, the bullets, and the primers. Well, maybe the primers are pretty consistent, but the casing and the bullet. And you can actually get it even more. I mean, there's guys out there will weigh and trim the cases. They'll weigh the bullets. They'll do everything such that they get as perfectly duplicated loads in every single one. And you can be as, you know, OCD as you want about this. But guarantee whatever you make is going to beat store-bought.
Yeah.
With the exception of perhaps some of the high-end defensive rounds.
Right.
And mass-grade stuff.
And I talked to guys. Now, I was always doing just straight casing pistol loads, 9mm, 38, 357, 45. But I would talk to guys who were doing rifle ammo, and I was using a powder thrower. Now, for people who aren't in this yet, we'll just kind of go ahead and run through the different material you use from... You've gone to the range, and you've been a range chicken, and you picked up a bunch of brass, and you got a bag of brass, and now you bring it home. Now, where do you go from there?
Well, I mean, the first thing you do is you've obviously got some mucky, dirty-looking brass, because more than likely it's been kicking around the dirt and whatnot. So the first thing you got to do, you got to clean it up. There's several ways of doing that. Some people do it all fang-dangled with ultrasonic cleaners, you know, stainless steel pins in liquid emulsions and stuff like this. But it can be as simple as, you know, a vibratory cleaner with corn cob in it.
Yeah, that's what I had. I just had a Lee tumbler. It was a big, probably a one-quart bowl with corn cob in it and a little bit of chemical in there, and that was it.
And you know, you dump in some of that corn cob. What I have, I always put in about every three or four runs on that thing, I'll put in a cap full of new finish, car polish.
Right.
And that, and also, here's another tip. Take some dryer sheets, use dryer sheets, cut them up into pieces like, you know, maybe four pieces, line pieces per sheet, throw them in there, and it'll catch a lot of the dust and dirt in it as well.
Oh, there you go. That's a nice trick.
So, yeah, you pull them out, and they're pitch black. They go in white, they come out pitch black because they've captured a lot of the dirt and crap that comes off the casings. But after all that, basically, you've got tumbled brass. Now, some people like to decap the brass before they put it in there so they clean the primer pockets and stuff. Again, how OCD do you want to be? You can do as much as you want. I personally don't care. Not for, I don't know about what you're loading nowadays, but like for 45 ACB, if I feel like doing it, I'll decap it, but it's only because I'm going to eventually decap it anyway.
Well, see, and when I did it, I started out with my first initial set of dies were steel dies, so I had to lube them and do all that other stuff.
Yeah.
But what I come up with was steel dies, you think they're steel and you can't hurt them, but you can scratch them.
Yeah.
So I always threw my brass in the tumbler first and cleaned them. And then I would size them and deprime them. And then once or twice, just because I had somebody telling me to do it, I threw them back in the tumbler.
Yeah.
To clean the well out, because therefore I was never, my casings went into my dies clean.
One of the things that the guys are doing nowadays is called the LSD method, which is lemon shine and detergent. And basically you take a little bit of the lemon shine cleaner, put it in warm water, and then you put like a squirt of Dawn liquid in there, throw your brass casings in that. You can deprime first if you want. You stick it in there and you shake it up, leave it overnight. Get up the next morning, shake it up again, and rinse off with good clean water. And, of course, we're here in Texas, so you can just lay them out blanket in the sun.
Yeah.
Absolutely, like, you know, parking lot car shiny.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely gorgeous. So, again, you know what? You don't need to go out and get a tumbler. You don't need to go out and do all that stuff if you don't want to. There's ways of doing this. But, anyway, that's basically what we're saying here. Is pick a way to clean it. You really should, because it will, even with the carbide dyes, you'll get schmutz up in there, and you're getting dirt in around equipment, and it's precision equipment, to be honest.
Right.
So first thing you gotta clean it, period. Right. And so basically, once you do that, be it either with ultrasonics or tumbling like we do and whatnot, you get them out, and the thing is that once the round is fired, it expands out. The brass is malleable and expands out, seals into chamber as the bullets flying out the other end of it. So basically, it's out of spec for size. You're not going to be able to rechamber it, and it's probably stretched as well. Like if you're talking rifle rounds, they absolutely do stretch out. So now the flat or the straight ball cases like 38 Special and 45, they normally don't, not very much anyway. And stuff like 45 ACP is such low pressure that you really, really got to hammer it to get it to stretch out long enough to trim it. But anyway, basically now you got a, if you haven't decapped it, by decapping it, I mean, you got to poke out the used primer because it's still sitting there, right? So once you have it set up clean, you bring it over to your press, and you have a die in there, a sizing die, which will have a decapping pin in there as well, if you haven't decapped it, and it'll resize it. So once you do that, now really, that's a lot of the physical effort that's required. The rest of it doesn't take much, actually.
Okay, now let's stop there. I want to devil into that a little deeper.
Yep.
In the beginning, most people, the only carbide die you actually need, if you're going to run carbide, which I recommend, is the sizer. And all of this stuff, when you first get set up, you have to set these dies up. They don't come factory set.
Correct.
So you have to set them up so they deprime them, drops the primer, sizes the shell. Now, the carbide is better because you don't have to use any lubricant. You just kind of want a clean shell.
Now, we're talking about straight case, like string right. mold cases here, like pistol and whatnot, and some, and to a certain extent, some rifle cases can do it as well. Like you could manage to do it with a 45-70. I wouldn't recommend it.
A 30 carbine, that kind of stuff. The only pistol round that comes to mind that to me is a Wildcat is a 357 SIG because it's a necked cartridge.
Or that silly golly, what is it, that French one, the one on the PS90 round, what is that? The FN round?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I've seen it.
Yeah, it's rifle and pistol, right?
So. Yeah. So we're talking about, you can start out with the steel dies. What I would recommend, you know, is that immediately get your dies and buy the carbide sizer immediately. It will cut out an entire step and a bunch of mess.
Yeah, and all the manufacturers, and you know the show, like, you know, there's Lee, there's Hornady, there's RCBS, there's Redding, all those guys. You can go out and you can buy what we're talking about. There's going to be a set of dies required to do all this work. You can say, I want to reload 9mm. You can go out and you can buy the set of dies, carbide dies as well, so that what we're talking about here now, you get it in a kit. So it's not like you're having to match, you know, like if you get your car fixed, you don't have to match the tire to the rim to all that part. It comes in a kit.
And it's a pretty cute little. I had RCBS, so there's little. It's a little green box. It's about the size of a good sized sandwich.
Yeah.
And now, what are they going for now? I remember when I bought them, they were. I think my steel dies cost me. I think they came with my kit, or they were like $40 or $50, and then my carbide die alone was $40.
They've gotten a little bit cheaper nowadays. You can actually get the kit. I know. I got the Lee 9mm kit, which is the 4-piece dies, for, I think it's $30 delivered, like from...
Oh, okay.
It's not... You can, I mean, again, if you want to go OCD with it, you can buy, you know, the seating dies with the micrometer dials on it so you can have your seating to within 1,000. And those will run you anywhere upwards of $100 to $120 just for the seating die.
Right.
But... again, you know what? If you're just getting into this, $30-$40 gets you the basic die hardware to do it.
Right. Okay.
And they're all interchangeable. Like we're talking here now about this press and that press. Other than the Hornady lock and load system, all the presses, all the single stage presses, and even most of the multi stage presses, they all have the same threading. So when you buy the die, you can use it. An RCBS rock trucker, you can use it in a single stage, you can use it in a Dillon if you want.
Right.
So it's most of this stuff that we're talking about is standardized anyway.
Right. And something else that I'm trying not to forget anything, because for people who've never done this, they don't understand what it looks like. Once you get into this and you get running two or three different calibers, you say, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to reload 9mm, and you pull out your 9mm dies. And you've already preset those based on what you're doing, and you just run that. And then you unscrew them, you put them back in the box, and then, okay, now I'm going to run some 45, and you've already done those dies. So set up, once all your stuff is tuned the way you want it, is you're set up and you're running in a matter of a minute or two.
Yeah, and they're all a little bit different on how they set up and run. There's, like I said, the Hornady lock and load system has collets and collars and stuff that just... You know, it's basically a reset every time that it holds the setting no matter what you do. The other ones, there may be you're going to have to tweak them every time because basically you're dealing with screwing something into a thread. But like you say, you're usually pretty darn close.
Okay. Okay. So we covered that we're going to size and deprime, or you call it decapping the shell.
Yeah.
So we've cleaned and we've sized and deprimed.
Right. So now, the next thing you got to do is, so you have your shell, your casing. There's really two components that cause the burn. It's the powder and the primer. So what we have to do now is we have to prime the case. So you can buy primers in packs of, they're usually like a pack of 100. And it's usually like if you were to get the, I don't know, was it maybe 2 inches by 2 inches? It's a little pack, a little box,
yeah.
Maybe a quarter of an inch thick. there would be 100 primers in there. When you buy a box, there's 1,000. So there's 10 of those packs. So you can go and buy 1,000 primers for about, I think it's about 30, 35 bucks maybe.
Yeah.
So, I mean, think about that. 35 bucks, that's not a whole lot of ammo, really, when you think about it. But 35 bucks for 1,000 rounds or a portion of the 1,000 rounds, it's pretty good.
Right.
So anyway, there's the primers are different as well. There's pistol primers and rifle primers. And there's also small and large. And then there's normal and magnum. So you have to decide what you're going to use and what round it's destined for. Like, obviously, you're shooting 357 magnum. That's going to be a magnum primer. And I believe, is it a small? I think it's a small primer, isn't it?
Yeah, 357 was. And I'm not shooting 357 anymore. Now I'm running 45, which is a large pistol primer.
Right.
But the 9mm, I want to say, is a small pistol primer.
Correct, yeah. So, and again, and it's even, you can even get, you know, match-grade primers and things like that. And then there's even, CCI makes a military-grade primer, which is basically, it's a little bit harder to go off. People say it's a type of magnum primer, but other people say that there's something with the guts of the geometry that it basically requires a harder hit for it to go off, which will prevent slam fires in M1As and Marantz and things like that.
Right.
So again, you just have to decide what are you loading. I mean, let's stick with 9mm since we're doing that. So you got your 9mm, you got your case done and sized, right? But get yourself some small pistol primers, and it doesn't matter. You can do CCI, Federal, Winchester, Remington. It's all big name stuff, right? And then you have to stick the primer in the primer pocket in the bottom of the bullet. And how did you do that, Joe? Did you do it with a separate piece, or did you do it with the press?
I did it with the press. Now, I had a guy that at the gun shop, and he did it with a little hand deal where he he's got a little tray, I don't know, 8 inches across maybe, and all the primers were in it. But he had this little tray, and he'd shake it, and the primers would write themselves. And then all he'd do is he would squeeze the thing, and it would drop a primer into the little primer feed, and he'd put a shell on there, a casing, and he'd just squeeze it once, and it would prime it, and he'd move it. And he was pulling out of one basket and throwing in another. Right. And he said he'd just sit in front of the TV for hours and prime casings.
Yeah, it's pretty mindless work. It's something that, you know, it's one of these things. I remember somebody kind of on one of the forums kind of screamed at me, "How can you be watching? Because I'm sitting in my reloading room and I had a hockey game up on the TV, and they're yelling at me. First of all, what the hell are you doing watching hockey? You're in Texas." You know, it's a real man's sport. We'll leave it at that. And I said, "Look, this is mindless. This is, you know, it goes in one way. If it doesn't go in, then it's going in wrong, and you take that case and you chuck it to the side and you look at it afterwards.
Right.
Otherwise, you just keep on doing it." And really, it's kind of like that with sizing as well. As long as you got the die set up, you can sit there and be watching the movie, just cranking it in the press, one after the other. It's what I call mindless prep work, and it's the stuff I hate, but it's, you know, some of the things that you have to do.
Right.
So, yeah, I've done that. I've got the RCBS hand tool that you can put a tray of 100 primers in there, and it's like you say, they're flipped the correct way, I think, facing, which way do they face? They face down, right, because then they slide into the hole. When you squeeze your hand, there's a little ram that comes up and pushes it up into the primer pocket.
Right, pushes it up and usually flattens it out a little bit.
Yeah. And I mean, there's all kinds of systems. There's RCBS makes a real neat one where it's got like a little arm that rocks back and forth that drops a primer into a little cup, which then when you bring the handle down, it drops the case in there and primes it. And it's, you know, it's pretty neat. Now, again, 100 ways to skin a cat. However you want to do it. Most of the presses have some method of priming on the press as well. So if you don't want to spend another 30 bucks on a priming tool, well, like the RCBS Rock Chugger has a little part in there that kind of flips a little tray or a little arm below the shell plate holder, so that when you push the arm of the press forward, it pushes the case down, and then of course with the primer sitting there, the primer gets jammed up into the primer pocket.
Yeah, now the hand tool that you mentioned, the big plus side that I'd always heard, and again, I didn't use it, but in your case, you have to be, if you don't have the hand tool, you have to be sitting in your reloading room with a press doing it.
Yeah.
So the nice part about the hand tool is you can sit in the living room with your wife, sitting there watching your favorite hockey game or whatever, and you just sit there and just, if she can get past the hearing of the tink of, you know, a couple hundred shells, you know, casings hitting a basket.
Yeah.
You can do that anywhere you want.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And, you know, this is part of the reason why I got a reloading room, so I get the heck out of everybody's way and do this on my own time. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. But anyway, basically there's several ways and several methods to prime, and you know it's you will get the feel for it. You get these tools in your hands and you stick a shell case there and you go to prime with the hand tool and you will feel the pressure and the little pop like you're popping a zit in your finger, you know?
Right.
And you will get to know that feeling. So you can be there mindlessly just putting that in there and you will feel it out of your hand. It's if one of the primers is upside down.
Right.
Or going in sideways, you will physically feel it.
Right.
Again, practice, you know, just like anything else. But anyway, so that basically now you have a prime casing, prime shell that you're ready to start working with. And generally speaking, I like to get all this stuff out of the way. I like to clean, size, and prime hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases. So that, because that's the dreary, boring, pain in the rear work. So I'll have hundreds of cases, you know, like this afternoon I had like 545 cases sitting there in a pile. They're all ready to go.
Right. Now,
because I hate doing it.
Yeah, and then there, the only thing I'd like to tell people is when you do that, you have to, one, keep these primed casings in a cool, dry area. Because you've already added a component, which would be the primer, you have to know which component that is. You cannot mix and match a CCI small pistol primer with a Remington small pistol primer. They're going to act different.
Well, you can if you don't care. Again, how OCD do you want to get, right?
Well, to me, I've always thought that the change is a zero because one primer may be a little hotter than the other and vice versa. Yeah, it's an OCD thing.
Yeah. Again, if you're working up a load, and that's part of the jargon here, that, again, you can have, you know, federal cases, CCI number, what's it, 250 primers or whatnot, and type of powder and the type of bullet, all this stuff weighed to the, you know, plus or minus 0.2 grains or something. You can do all that. I don't for my plinking rounds. I just grab a handful of brass, and the only reason that the primers are all the same is because that's the box I hauled out.
Right.
So, but yeah, you are correct. The some of the primers do burn a little differently, a little bit hotter, a little bit harder, and things like that. So you absolutely can sort them out. There's no reason not to if you want to do it. But anyway, once you have that though, now you've got basically, you're ready to load, for lack of a better description. And the next step is to drop a powder charge. And basically, this is what's going to go off from after the primer ignites. The primer ignites the powder, which goes off, which expands, which makes gas, which increases the pressure, which then, you know, pushes the bullet down the barrel. Now, this is where the preparation and safety comes into play, like we were talking about earlier, having multiple references and checks and things like that. There's many stories, and you've probably seen pictures of, you know, guns practically exploded in people's hands and whatnot. And this is one of the inherent dangers of doing this if not careful. I've never had it done. I've never seen it happen. I've had a squib load, which for anybody that doesn't know, it's basically it's not enough charge to get the bullet down the barrel. So you'll get, which is very unhealthy as well, because you'll have the projectile stuck down the barrel. And if you're shooting a semi-automatic and you pull that trigger again when another round gets loaded into the chamber, guess what's happening?
Yeah, your barrel's blown up.
You're going to get a real big surprise, right?
Yeah.
So, again, this is a big part. This is where you definitely do not want to be watching the hockey game. You want to be paying attention to what you're doing. Joe, I don't know about you, but I would usually reference at least two load books. Because they're all about the same. And normally, if it's a new caliber or something I'm tinkering with, I'll usually start right in the middle. So if it says between 4 to 6 grains of bullseye powder for my .45 ACP, I start at 5. It's right in the middle. You know, why not? Can't hurt.
Yeah, and my way of doing it was a little different. The guy that kind of talked me through it, you know, let's use your 4 to 6 grains of powder for this load. I would start at about, like you, I would start at about 4.4, and then I'd do my next, I'd do 6 round loads. So it'd be 6 rounds of 4.4, then I'd do 6 rounds of 4.6, 4.8, all the way up to, you know, whatever it was, 5.6 or whatever. And I would document each of these on a fresh target, each of these 6 round sets. And what you're going to see is you're going to end up with maybe a 4-6 inch group, and you're not worried about where you're hitting on the target as much as you're worried about the group.
Right.
And the group will shrink, and then it will hit a point, and the group will open back up.
Right.
And what I would do is I would grab the three center loads that gave me the best group, and then I would drop them down to the tenth of the grain. And you're right; it was typically right in the middle.
Yeah, there's a process, I think it's called OCW, optimal charge weight. You can look it up online, and basically it's doing what you're talking about, where you take a spread and you go, okay, this particular charge worked best, or can it get any better? So I'll vary that one a little bit up and down.
Right.
Right? And eventually you'll keep wearing that charge to a more exact charge weight. So you'll start at, you know, 4.4 plus or minus 0.5 grains. That'll be, you know, 4.46 was what you liked. So you go 4.46 plus or minus 0.2 grains. And you'll keep on whittling down your spread until you get to what is an optimal charge for that particular firearm.
Right.
So people can go look that up. It's just called optimal charge weight, and it's a whole process. You know, fortunately, it takes a whole bunch of shooting, so it requires lots of range trips, right? So that's good.
Yeah, see, that's where I'm spoiled. I've got my own range. So okay, so we're talked about the zeroing of the load and how much powder you're going to use. And again, we're using the books for this.
Right.
Okay. Now there's multiple methods to throw powder.
Yeah. I don't know, again, I don't know about you, but when I first started, I actually had a progressive press that I set up as a single stage initially. So I would, you know, load the brass, and I'd size them all. Then I would, you know, prime them all, and then I would charge them all and whatnot. Whereas with some of the press systems, you can do it all in one fell swoop if you need to. But let's consider that we're still doing this one stage at a time. You can, there's several ways of doing it. You can do it, you know, mechanically, or you can do it with volumetrics. The most straightforward way of doing it, you've probably seen them, the lead dimmer cups. Have you seen those?
Yeah, I always kind of thought those were more for shotgun. What I used to do was I used to just have my scale and a trickler.
Yep.
A little hourglass trickler, and you just roll your finger across the little wheel, and it would, the faster you went, the faster the powder went. When I got close to where I wanted to, it would tilt my little scale and put me right where I wanted, and I would hand throw my zero loads when I was zeroing a load, and then once I got my load zeroed and I liked it, then I would use a powder thrower,
right,
which is a long tube, and it just, you have to play with it and get it where it matches up with your scale, and then I would throw 5 or 10 and measure one. Throw 5 or 10 and measure one.
Yeah.
And when you
again, this just depends again on how OCD you want to be.
Right.
If it was a plinking round, I don't care.
Well, to me, pistol rounds, once you get a pistol round set up, other than just the safety of checking them, you know, every 20 or something, 10, 20 rounds, that's fine. Now, when you get into rifle rounds, you're talking about wanting to hit something at 200 to 800 yards away. I'm gonna trickle every one of those.
Now this is a good point right here. This is one piece of equipment. There's a couple of pieces of equipment you do not want the spring drop. For the love of God, get yourself a sensor scale. In fact, get two. Get a manual one. Get a regular beam scale.
Right.
And an electronic one. And you can also buy from RCBS is one of the places I get. You can get what they call calibration weights. They range these little pieces of metal that range from, I think it's 0.2 or 0.5 grains all the way up to like 50 grains. So you can see for sure when you drop 5 grains or let's say 40, let's say you're dropping 46 grains of target for your 308 load. You can actually make sure that what your scale is telling you is there is truly what's there by using those calibration weights.
Right.
And fortunately, I haven't had to fuss with it. But if your scales are off, you end up having to kind of use a little bit of math to ratio it to suit.
Right.
But it's ultra important here, guys, that you have good scales, and that's both. And I recommend getting a regular. And, old-fashioned beam scale, as well as one of the good electronic ones, and it's going to cost you, but you can use it for everything you're doing, everything from weighing cases, bullets, and charges for every single caliber. So
yeah.
Do not scrimp on your scales.
Yeah. See, I started out with the little beam scale because it was part of my kit, but I was zeroing loads, so it was fine, and I was really trying to get nitpicky on it. And then once I got all of my dies zeroed and all my charges, and I created a little book, my little reloading book that had all of my loads in it. And once I had that down, then I went ahead and I bought the digital scale just for testing. So I could throw one and set it over there to the side while it was zeroing out and checking itself out. I'm throwing more shells. My powder thrower. So, yeah, when you start out real slow and then you start getting into more faster mass production. I just had the rock chucker, the RCBS rock chucker. And now me and Dave are looking at either doing a Lee Progressive or a Dillon.
Yeah, I bought a Dillon there last year, and it's quite thrilling, I tell you what. So, because I like you, I kind of started with a single stage, and I got an orderly lock and load, and it was kind of buggy for me. I mean, that's not saying anything bad for Morty. They're nice rigs. But I used to frustrate me a little bit, so I was like, "No, I'm just gonna, no pun intended, bite the bullet," and I ran out and I popped the deal on that. And again, just as an example, this afternoon I spent about, including setup and cleanup afterwards, in 3 hours I did 500 rounds of 45.
Yeah.
God bless it. It's like, it just makes life easier.
Yeah.
Once you get it set up and run.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
But anyway, there's multiple ways of doing it. What I also do, I got sick and tired, like you trickle. I do trickle as well, but I got sick and tired of, taking me an hour to do 20 shells. So what I did, I went out and bought the RCBS electronic one that spits out the powder to the weight. So what I do then is let's say again, let's get back to loading for 308. If I'm doing 46 grains, I will set it up to spit out to 45 grains, and then I will trickle the last grain. But it does it automatically.
Right.
So while you're trickling the grains for the next round, it's loading up, it's throwing the next set of powder.
Right.
And it is, oh man, it is awesome. It's just like the best.
Yeah.
But there's many ways of doing it. At the end of the day, you're looking for a specific weight of powder, and everybody needs to understand that with, again, let's say 308, there's how many types of bullets? There's got to be 20 different types, from full metal jacket to soft points, and then there's you know, they start at, what's it, was 110 grains is the lightest bullet. I think you can get 308 up to 200, is it?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not a big 308 guy. Yeah, maybe.
I think it's like 200 grains. So, you know, all of those bullets require different charges. And in fact, the lighter bullets prefer a different type of powder. So this is where, again, you got to be paying attention and using your reference material. You know, your books again. I don't know about you, but whenever I do a set of reloads, if it's not something that's tried and true, I'll have at least three of them.
Right.
On the bench here. And everything is different. Everybody will say something different, and of course the internet knows everything apparently. But you really have to be kind of on top of your game when it comes to this. So keep in mind that, you know, standard 150 grain or 147 grain full metal jacket 308 round is not going to be the same charge, maybe not even the same powder, as the 168 grain matched bullet.
Right, right.
So that's another thing to keep in mind here, is not only are you paying attention to the powder and the weight you're using, but how it goes to or goes with that particular bullet. So anyway, you drop the charge, and like I said, you can do it either with powder cups, you can trickle it out onto beam scales, you can use electronic dispensers, which is kind of what I use mostly nowadays, things like that, or in a progressive press, there's a lot of powder drops, like the Dillon. I'll tell you what, that Dillon, I was getting it to drop 5 grains of bullseye, and it was doing it every time. Every time. I did about, I don't know, maybe 20 or 30, and I'd stop and I'd check. And I'd check four, like 3 or 4 in a row, and they would all be at 5 grains. So then I'd do 100. And then I'd check it again, another couple in a row, and it was still holding 5 grains. I did 500 rounds of 45, and it held 5 grains.
Yeah, see, that's like when they actually, yeah, they hold like that. But again, like you said, you know, like Dave does, you can get a Virgo moment, and you know you're going to check a whole lot just to make sure that you got it right, because this stuff is serious.
Yeah. You have to kind of have faith in yourself. You have to have earned faith in the equipment, things like that. And stuff breaks, right? This is all mechanical stuff,
right?
And you
have to check it for safety's sake.
Right. And it even gets to the point where, let's say if I do 100 rounds, every single round I will chamber check with a little case gauge, but I will randomly grab them as well and put them on my scale. Now, I know that the bullets and the casings and everything are going to be a little bit of different weight, but if I put one on there and I zero the scale and I put another one on there and it's within, you know, plus or minus 1.5 grains.
Yeah, right.
Now, if I put another one on there and it's minus, you know, 7 grains, I go, hold on now. Guess what? That one gets moved aside.
Yeah, see, and doing that, I have actually, and I think anybody who has done enough reloading has screwed up and double charged.
Yeah.
I've done that where I'm running them through a tray, and in my little hand tray, I would only do every other slot, so therefore I had space to do everything I needed to do. And I'd always sit there and I'd shake them and I'd look at them before I went to start putting the bullet heads on. I'm like, ooh, something's up with that one.
Yeah,
and you got to dump them. I've never fired one, but I've double charged a couple.
Yeah. Again, there's systems with the Dillon that help prevent that, but that's for another discussion. But anyway, so you've decided on what you're going to charge, so you've dumped your charge in there. You've, for lack of a description, you've put the stuff in there that's going to make it all go bang. So now if we're talking about pistols, you kind of have to do a secondary prep to the case. You have to flare the case mouth a little bit. Basically, before the bullet can go in there, you have to kind of flare the case mouth out a bit so that the bullet can actually be jammed down in the case. If you don't, you're going to shave the edge off the bullet and maybe even crush the case sides, because things are pretty snug. Again, but that will be included in the kit that you buy.
Yeah, I think the way I had mine set up, I think it was, and this has been a few years now, I think it was clean, Size and D-Prime was the next stage. And I think it was Flare after that, and then it was Prime. And I might have those backwards. But yeah, I've done that. I've done that where I forgot to, I got to flare them. And yeah, and the bullet goes in and it rips half the casing apart.
Yeah. So, but I mean, that's again, that doesn't really take much effort. It's once it's set, it's not a super duper exact science. You can do, you just need a, just barely enough of the flare on the case so you can lay the bullet on there and it doesn't tip off.
Right.
And again, this is an experience that you're just going to have to look and try.
And it's a feel thing, like you said earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, when one goes bad, you feel it.
Yeah. So once you got that done, basically you can take your bullet and lay it on top of your case. Now you have to seat the bullet. And again, this is a very important stage because you want the bullet seated to a certain depth so that, number one, it's not too long, because if it's too long, if you have a semi-automatic firearm, it's not going to fit in the magazine. It's not going to feed.
It won't chamber, right.
Yeah, you won't get it. You won't get it in the battery. So it has to be, you know, there's a maximum length. Again, this will be in the book, in these books that you bought. All this information that we're talking about, the, you know, charges and lengths and diameters and weights and stuff like this, it's all in those books. So nobody needs to panic. You can just sit down and spend a weekend reading up on this stuff and all this gobbledygook we're talking about. There are numbers for it. And they're in black and white, and it'll tell you maximum cartridge length, COL, cartridge overall length, is such and such. Do not exceed. Right. The same thing with the case.
Right.
Case length, trim length has got to be this amount. So all of this stuff is tried and true, and to specification. You're not reinventing the wheel. You just have to be careful about what you're doing. So. What you do now is you have another die, so you take your flaring die out and you put your bullet seating die in. And basically you screw that into the press, you stick your bullet on top of the case, and you push the case up into this die, and there's a little header in there that basically pushes the bullet into the case. So you'll take it out, and here's the other important piece of equipment, set of calipers, right? Get yourself a decent set of calipers. You will use them forever. If they're good, they will last you a long time, and they will be accurate. And you will measure the length overall of the thing from the base of the case to the nose of the bullet. And that has to be within the specification, what's listed in reloading books.
Right. Now, something else is when you're seating that bullet, some bullets actually have a neck on them or a little ribbed edge, and the bullet will actually crimp into that.
Yeah.
So that just ensures you have a proper seat.
Yeah. So basically once and admit, this is going to be a trial and error thing. You'll go say, I want my 45 to be 1.255, and you stick it in there once, and you measure it's like 1.52. Ooh, that's way too much. So you'll dial the die in a little bit. You'll push the case up into the die, pull it back down. You'll remeasure it. You'll get close, and eventually you should get it nuts on. At which point you go, I'm set. Now, there's a lot of dies out there that will also do a second process, which is called crimping. And basically what you're doing, you're forming the brass around the bullet a little bit snug and pushing the edge of the open mouth into the bullet a little bit. You're grabbing on, and the whole purpose of this is that you get consistent tension between the bullet and the case.
Right.
I mean, there's other reasons for it. I always put a very, no matter what I'm doing, I always put a very, very, very light crimp. There are certain rounds that do require a heavy crimp. I shoot 45-70. That requires a crimp because those suckers can jump.
Right.
But even on a full metal jacket 45, which is not really, I don't believe it's necessary, I always put a little bit in it just for consistency.
Right.
So, and some of the dies that they have, like the Lee dies, they do indeed do both of these steps in one step. So you can crimp and seat the bullet all in one fell swoop. I won't get into how that goes on, but you can set it up. And once you've got it set up, you just start sticking a charge case in there, put a bullet on it, crank it down. You're done.
Yeah, my RCBS, that's what it did. Was it seated and crimped.
Yeah. Now I usually do crimping as a separate step. I have what they call the factory crimp die. So I pull the die back so it does not crimp, but I just seat, and then I crimp afterwards. To me, I just prefer to do it that way. Again, it's however the heck you want to do it. How OCD do you want to be? I'm kind of OCD about crimping.
Right.
But basically, after that, Joe, you're good. You have to obviously take measures to make sure that, look at the round, make sure that the primer is still set back in the primer pocket, but it's not pushed out. You look and you make sure that, the case looks good, that you didn't split the wall of the case in some stupid move. Because that happens. It's, the bullet goes in a little, 5 or 10 degrees off kilter, and it'll push out the side of the case. And some people even have, like I have them, every caliber I have what they call a chamber gauge. And, what the heck, is it a chamber gauge or chamber measuring? It's not a measuring tool. Basically, it's a little chunk of steel with the chamber of whatever round you're using built into it. So you can drop your 45, your 308 finished round in there, and it'll fit in there just as though it's in the rifle or the pistol.
Right.
And I check every one of those. I know it sounds mind-numbing, and it is, but I've never had a problem. So once you've done all that, technically you have a round that's good to go.
Okay, and now something else that I think is an important part is when you box this ammo up, you've got this bucket of ammo when you're done, hopefully, and you go to box it up, one of the old school reloading rules is each box has to actually have all of the ingredients, the measurements, everything written on it.
Yeah.
So you got to document that.
Yeah, you do. There's, I do it on a spreadsheet, and then I have labels that I write on my boxes. You want to do it in a book, in a binder on your desk, same thing. But, it kind of lets you know when was it done, how was it done, what did you use. And the important thing about this, Joe, is, and you know this too, you'll go and you'll shoot and you'll go, oh, wow, that sucks.
And you go back, but you can go back and look and see what you did different.
Yeah, and you go, huh, okay, guess I won't be using federal primers anymore, that type of thing.
Yeah,
that was the only difference.
Yeah, see, that was my thing. Once I zeroed a load, I always used the same primer for every, for that load consistently. And if I couldn't get primers, I just didn't get it. Or I'd work up a load with the other one, and if I couldn't get these, I'd run those and whichever.
Right, right. And again, this is one of the beauties of reloading, that you can blame something else other than yourself.
Yeah. Now back to something else you said early on was the pride in reloading. I don't think it applies as much with pistol, which maybe to some people it does, as it does to rifle.
Yeah.
But I can see it with rifle really big, is that you go out, and I don't care if you're hunting a deer, a fox, a caribou, whatever, a moose. You started from components, built your bullets, made your shot, dropped your animal. You did all of this completely on your own.
Yeah.
You had a rifle with all of its different components. So you took all of these components, and from start to finish, you did this.
And you know what, Joe? Let's take it even a step further. You made the you used the 45-70, so you made your own black powder, and you made the bullet. You cast the bullet.
Yeah.
I mean, technically, the only thing that you had to buy then was the primer.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you have the ability to do that. Most people don't, but a lot of people do. And to be honest, you can cast bullets for darn near any caliber if you really want to. And a lot of guys, I don't know if you've seen it lately, but a lot of guys are using powder coating on their bullets. So that they can load them up to higher pressures and not foul up their gas systems,
right.
Their ARs and stuff.
So right.
There's ways around this where you can make 90% of the stuff yourself.
Yep.
So and then you read that, well, just like you said at the beginning of the show, you said, you're being a range chicken and going around. Well, you're recycling that brass. From people that aren't going to use it anymore, and I don't know how many times you reload stuff, but I know for a fact I'm looking at one box here, and this is the sixth time I reloaded this brass for 45.
Yeah, so. Now there's a point, and a problem I had at one point was, it's not worth looking at dirty brass. Go ahead and throw your brass in your tumbler or however you're cleaning it and get it out. And when you get it out, I used to just sit there in front of the TV and I just grab a shell and I just look at it and then toss it over to the side and look at the next one. And I would start finding shells or casings that were bad, had cracks in them, looked deformed, and those just go in the trash.
If somebody really wants to start off basic, Joe, might I suggest that they get a Lee Classic Reloader. Those kits that you could use, basically, if you got a plastic mallet and a piece of 2x4, you can do it.
And oh, I know which one you're talking about. Yeah, yeah, you can carry it in your truck.
Yeah, and if you just want to try it, I mean, it's kind of slow, but you know what? Even those little sets will give you a round that is still more consistent than factory.
Yeah, we started looking up here. We've got a gun store out here by the lake, and we were just in there just perusing guns one day, and they had a Lee Progressive kit for like $150 without the dies, and then the guy had all the dies for like $40 a box.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, we need to get back into this. And right now, I think now how are components right now? I mean, that was our kind of our break point was like, okay, if we get all the stuff, that's great, but can you find components? I know you're down in the Houston, San Antonio area, so how are components to find?
Everything, with the exception of powder, is around somewhere. It may not be the regular store that I go to. If I go out and if I want to get, you know, my CCI primers or my Sierra Match King bullets or whatever, I may end up having to go to one or two places to get it on the way home. Powder is like hen's teeth. It's very hard to get. What I usually end up doing is going online to one of the online guys, and I'll back order it, and I'll order 5 pounds of it on back order, and in 3 or 4 months I'll get it. But it's very difficult to find, especially the more popular powders like Bullseye and Varga. Those are the go-to powders for 45, 38, a lot of the pistol calibers. Varga is for many, many, many other rifle mounts. It works for damn near anything that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Yeah, good luck finding those. They're difficult to find. So if you're going to get into this, you need to have sources. I mean that in plural.
Well,
you need to have places around town where you can stick your nose in every blue moon, and also at least 3 or 4 places online to order. And keep in mind, too, that if you order this stuff online, let's say a can of or a pound of Varga is $30. There's a $27 hazmat fee gets chopped out of that, too.
Yeah.
So this is why you need to buy it in bulk.
Yeah.
If you're going to buy it online.
Yeah. Now, something else, for people who are just thinking about the whole idea of reloading, is check out your Goodwill stores and all that for the books.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get the books, for a couple bucks. Or if you happen to be in a gun store and you see one, look through it. And here's something I'd like you to do, Mark, is when we complete the interview, send over just give me a shot of, of the 45 ACP or the 9mm for a book. Just to show, because what people don't understand is they're going to list 5 powders in a graph and the different chamber and the different velocities and pressures or whatever. And so you're looking, when you open a page and you look at, a 230 grain 45 ACP bullet, they're going to show you five different powders and the measurements, and then show you the velocity differences.
Keep in mind, too, it's for the benefit of the powder manufacturers to make that information available. So you can get this online as well. You can go to Alliant,
right,
or Hogden or whoever, and they will have some information online. So, again, you can use it as a cross reference. You can have a book for books and then look and see what the manufacturer says.
Right, like I said, that's exactly a good point, because they're trying to sell their stuff, so they're going to make it as easy to get as possible. Most of the books that I've found are all made by the bullet manufacturers themselves.
Yeah.
So they're like, hey, if you want to use our bullet, here's the book for it. But yeah, I think if you had three reloading books, you're good.
Yeah.
I mean, if you got more, that's fine. And then there was the old shooter's Bibles, and it was a big old book, and it showed catalogs of all these guns. Well, they got reloader Bibles, too.
The one thing that I should mention, too, here, and you understand, is that most of the stuff we're talking about here is pistol-related.
Right.
Rifle is a whole different ballgame, and if somebody was getting into reloading and they had the choice, I would start off with pistol. And I would start off with one of the common rounds first, like 45, 9, 38 special, something.
Straight neck, straight casing.
Yeah.
Yes, try to stay away from this 357 SIG, because if you can do that, you can do rifle.
Yeah, and then the rifle, I mean, I was doing 45 for probably the better part of a year before I ventured into rifle, because rifle is a bit more involved, and you're dealing with some really, really big pressures and tight tolerances as compared to a lot of the pistol cases. So it requires a little bit more experience. But I'm not trying to scare anybody off, but if you have the choice, try the pistol first.
Yeah, see, I never did get into rifle because I wasn't ready, and I was in the service. I was moving around too much. But, yeah, I mean, when you get into rifle, you're dealing with where the shoulder is, where the neck is, what the length is. Now you got to trim casings and...
Yeah.
It was a lot of stuff I really wasn't ready for at the time, so I'd always done just straight neck pistols.
But the thing about it is that how we were talking about how you save money, this is where it really gets pronounced. Because once you tweak a load, basically you've made a match round for your rifle.
Right.
Go out someday, just go to Midway or Cabela's or something, anywhere at all. Look up a Nosler 30 cal match grade round for whatever. I bet you it's about $2 a bullet.
Yeah.
If you're reloading from brass that you've already once fired, you're nowhere near that. And you will, once you tweak the load and match the primer and all that good stuff, you will keep up with those big fancy rounds.
Yeah, because when I was doing all the reloading, yeah, it was nothing for me to go down and, I mean, I think that I was into it for maybe $20 and shoot hundreds of rounds. Because, I mean, well, let's take it for instance. You're there in your reloading room. Grab a caliber and let's just say, you know, what is a box of 100 or 200 bullet heads run?
Well, let's say, like, because I know I did 45 this afternoon, right? So Winchester white box is usually about $27-$28 plus tax. Let's call it $30, okay? So if it's $30 for Winchester white box, now the primers, I think, are about 35 per thousand. Let me get my calculator right here. So 35 per thousand, so 3.5 cents each. The powder, bullseye powder, I think I bought it at about $20 per pound. There's 7,000 grains per pound. I'm going all engineer on here. Excuse me for a second.
Virgo moment.
Yeah, here we go. Okay. So that means for every 5 grains of charge is about 1 cent per case. So that's 3.5 cents for the primer. And assuming that this is a once fired case, so you're keeping your brass, right?
Right.
Basically, you're talking, 26 cents each. Now, these are pretty high prices, by the way, compared to what they used to be. So you're talking about, 30 cents, 29.5 cents each times 50 cases is about $14-$15. So it's right off the bat, tab price. And that's with today's inflated prices.
Right. And then you're also talking about something that you know is going to beat a factory load.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
And my brass is going to be so much prettier than that garbage.
And that's per 100.
Well, that's per, I'm talking about 50 here. Because a 50 case is what you get with 45. Right? So, 50, like I said, Winchester white box is about $28-$30 for just Winchester white box now. This is just kind of generic stuff.
Right.
And I can get almost the equivalent of, you know, damn near match grade almost.
Yeah.
For about half that.
Yeah.
For 50. And that's, again, that's just, I'm just eyeballing costs here. I'm not, you know, going out and getting specific anything. Because once you get into those panic costs, right? Everything has gone up. Not only just the ammunition, but the components.
Oh yeah, people are hoarding components just like they're hoarding the ammunition.
Right. So when you can find it, it's still kind of inflated. So I'm positive that especially if you buy in bulk, if you buy 10 pounds of powder, 20,000 primers or 30,000 primers and things like that, I'm sure you can get that down to the better part of $10 per box of 50. So now you're down to a third the cost.
Right. Right.
And again, you know what? This is the one thing that I always tell people is that they say, well, why do you do it? It's costing the same thing. So, you know what? When this big ammo panic was going on, it had no effect on me. I made my own.
Right.
I could still go to the range. Remember when, right at the beginning of this whole panic, good Lord, I mean, there was nothing anywhere. And I was still going to the range. I was throwing 308 and 45 down range. Like, I didn't care, man.
Yep.
I'd show up with like about 4 or 5 mags worth of 308 and just shoot the snot out of my FAL for giggles.
Yeah.
And I didn't care because it was cheap and I was going to reload it anyway. So I had more ammo waiting for me. It just was sitting in components in my reloading room.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing about this is that if you're kind of ready for it, and it's the same thing with the preparedness mindset in general, that if you're ready for it and you've slowly but surely stocked yourself, then you've kind of insulated yourself against anything that happens. And this is a good point here is that if you make your own, you don't have to worry about having to go into the store and buy ammunition.
Right. Now, here's something. Here's a funny point that I went over, and Dave, Super Dave's all working on his garden, and he's all excited, and I went over and looked, and man, it's beautiful. I like, you so suck. Because I always started out with, a big garden, and he saw all my mistakes. But he had a funny comment to me today, and it goes into what we're talking about here. And he says there's hard preppers and soft preppers. And I kind of had him define that to me. A soft prepper just stocks up, okay, on food or bullets.
Right.
A hard prepper goes a step beyond and they grow their own food and they make their own bullets. Because when the supply is used up, you're just screwed.
Yeah.
Okay, but if you're growing your own food or if you're making your own bullets, they can't really slow you down or stop you much.
Yeah.
And I know, the gardening goes a little farther than the reloading would, but the theories there are still the same, is that if you can do it yourself consistently long term, you're not waiting on supply.
Yeah, and again, it's one of these things that everybody talks about, and you and Bob and everybody, playing, have a skill. Any skill, doesn't matter. It's got to be worth something.
Right.
And this is one of these things that, and actually, one of the other things you can look into is that you can be all high tech and fancy with electronic scales and Dillon presses and all this stuff. But you know what? When it comes down to it, I can be out in the middle of the woods as long as I got a pound of powder and a few primers and shell cases and bullets and that little $20 or $15 Lee set, I can make ammo right there.
Yeah, you can reload in the field.
Anywhere at all.
Yeah, so that's just funny.
Do it to freaking candlelight if you want. No power, no nothing. It's nice to be able to do that. There's a whole bunch of stuff that you obviously need power to do, but this is one of the things that you don't.
Really. Well, and that to me, that goes back to the whole, you can have the digital scales and the electric thrower. Start with everybody. Start simple. Start with everything just analog, non-electronic. Go that way because therefore you're doing it slow and you're getting it done. You're getting it done and then move up to the electronics because then you always have your backup.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Well, it looks like we're about an hour on this.
Yeah, yeah. We've kind of pushed this one.
We have way too much fun with this stuff. So.
Yeah. Well, okay. That's been great. I appreciate it, Mark. Now, for all of you that are going to be listening to this podcast, please jump in there. I've recently put up a post about wanting people who are very versed in an area. Marks is reloading. We've got people in different areas. I think I've got an upcoming interview with Fighter Doc. We're going to get into some medical stuff there. But I actually want to try to get some people who are doing these specific things and use them as a resource. You know, and some people, you know, I have time or I don't have time, but they'll get back to your question eventually, and please try to do it on the forum. And we're you know, me and Mark are here. We're trying to help support Bob. So just everybody, if you've got a purchase you've got to make and you use your Amazon, please go through Bob's site and help support Bob and help support the show. We know he's going through some stuff with his family, and we pray for them. Mark, you got anything to close?
Not really. Like I said, I would just take it on as, you know, it's a hobby at first, and then it kind of takes over. So just be prepared to, you know, start off with the excuse that, oh, I'm going to save money, and now you're just going to shoot a whole bunch more.
Yeah, good
but that's
stuff.
That again, like we said before, it's a good thing.
That is.
Just be safe about it, and if you're not sure, ask somebody. No, but all the guys that do this are a bunch of good old boys. They will help. They're more than happy to talk about their pent loads and their baby rifles and the bullets they cast and stuff like that. Ask. Nobody is going to belittle you or call you stupid.
No.
We're all greenhorns and one.
Yeah, and this is one of those very, very technical things, and yeah. I agree. When the guy started me out, yeah, they were always right there.
Yeah, so that's about it, Joe. I think this is just about to confuse everybody, you know?
Well, I think this will kind of whet their appetites, and if they can find out they can either save money, and that's how they'll explain it to their wives, and then they find out they can actually shoot more for the same money, they'll be okay. So, all right, well, I thank you, Mark. I appreciate it. I appreciate your time on a Sunday afternoon. And to everybody out there, let's keep moving forward and get it done.
Cheers.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thanks, guys. Once again, they donated their time. They put this together on their own, and I really appreciate it. I don't know how to thank you guys. It's great when listeners can help me out on subjects that they know. You know, with everything that I'm dealing with, all my family situations and me fighting cancer and my wife's illness and, you know, my son's been having a couple of issues and things too. I've been paying a lot of attention to family lately, and I need to. That's my number one priority. You know, God and family, those are my two top priorities. And that's where I need to be. So any help I can get from listeners that do guest podcasts like this, or if you want to call in voicemails and things like that, it really makes a big difference. Speaking of voicemails, my number is 210-646-1727. 210-646-1727 if you have a voicemail comment that you want to call into my show. Or you can go to handgunworld.com, and there's a call me button on the website. Also, speaking of handgunworld.com, if you want to subscribe to email updates, you can get an email every time I put up a podcast. It's kind of like a reminder that there's been a new episode put out. They usually come out on Sundays pretty regularly every week. Let me announce some classes coming up. I got a very special announcement. I'm doing a class in California, Northern California, at San Joaquin Gun Range. San Joaquin Gun Range. Scott is the host. And Scott, Northern California, has been a longtime listener of the show. I'm teaching Beyond Concealed Carry October 18th, Saturday, October 18th. If you are in Northern California or you're close to Northern California and you want to train with me, I will be the instructor. Ben's not going to be able to make this trip. I'll be doing the Beyond Concealed Carry. I'll be teaching that class. Scott is going to assist me in the instruction, and we're going to have plenty of safety officers and everything. It's in Northern California, not very far from Sacramento, at the San Joaquin Gun Range. I will put details on the website, a sign-up link, details about the class, what you need to bring, what you need to do, where it is, location, all that stuff. We're also going to include a barbecue lunch for everybody, which is really going to be cool. We're going to start about 8:30 and probably go until about 5:30. 8:30 to 5:30. The investment's only $200. It's going to include a barbecue lunch and the Beyond Concealed Carry class, the signature class that Ben and I teach. This is a class that's pretty much designed for somebody that has a concealed carry license, although in California probably there's not a lot of folks who do, but that's what it's designed for. It's designed to teach you how to fight with your handgun. It's designed to give you that first major step beyond your concealed carry license. That's why we called it that, on how to fight with your handgun, how to clear malfunctions, how to perform reloads, how to shoot on the move. And that's the main focus of it. How to get multiple hits on target real fast out of the holster. That's the basics of fighting with a handgun. This is a great step for you to take, even if you've never come to a training class before. That's fine. We're going to start off real basic the first hour and a half or 2 hours and get the basics out of the way so that everybody has that down. You do need to have some experience drawing from the holster, though. So if you sign up for this class between now and October 18th, try to get some practice drawing from your holster. We are going to spend some time on that, though, in the class. I'm excited about going to Northern California, even though I got to use 10-round magazines. So that's October 18th. Go to handgunworld.com and get signed up for that. On October 11th, the Saturday before, Ben Branham's teaching a rifle class. I probably won't be at that one. But he's teaching a AR-15 spit. Well, you can bring an AK, or you can bring something like a Mini 14. He's teaching a fighting rifle class, and rifle fighting dynamics is what we call it. Rifle fighting dynamics is the name of the class. That's Saturday, October 11th in San Antonio at Cedar Ridge Range, and I think that's going to be 8:30 to 5:30. Also, you'll start with zeroing your rifle, and then after you get it zeroed, you're going to learn how to fight with it. So. Great class. Ben does a good job with his Marine Corps experience and all the training he's got with rifles. He puts on a very, very good class. You can go to handgunworld.com, get signed up for that too. That's $200 for the day. Let's see, what else can I announce? In December, we're teaching a night fighting class, fighting with your pistol at night. A whole different ball game than practicing during the daytime. And you know what's interesting is we find that a lot of defensive uses of a handgun, they occur at nighttime or in low light situations. But guess what? Most people practice during the daytime. Here's your chance to come out and practice at night. That's going to be held at a place to shoot range in San Antonio, and that's going to be in December. Check the website. Check my website for that too, handgunworld.com. The Shooters Club. Time's wasting. The drawing is June 30th. If you've been procrastinating, hurry up. Join our video club membership. Ben and I do very good instructional videos. We just put up a new one a couple of weeks ago. There's a great collection on there. It's only $75 per year. We're giving away a gun at the end of the month, some ammunition, a range bag, free tickets to our classes, and all that good stuff. I'm going to be doing that drawing on June 30th, so hurry up. If you are an active annual member, your name will be put into the drawing, and I'm giving away my Smith & Wesson M&P 9mm shield with extra magazines. So it'll be shipped to your FFL. So how's that? So get signed up for the Shooters Club. You can find that. There's a Shooters Club page. And if you don't want to spend any extra money, but you want to support me because you like the information I put out, all you have to do is if you want to purchase something on Amazon, just purchase it through my affiliate link, please, if you don't mind. Go to handgunworld.com, click the Amazon store page, and there's a direct link to my affiliate Amazon link, and I'll get a little commission every time you buy something on Amazon. So there's a way to support me if you don't want to spend any extra money on classes or video memberships or anything like that. Let's see, the last thing that I want to cover would be iTunes reviews. If you haven't never given me an iTunes review, I'd love one. If you listen to this podcast through iTunes, that would be great. I'd appreciate that. Put a review up there. Let people know what you think. There's a lot of reviews up there, but my podcast gets rated. When people search for gun podcasts, the ratings on iTunes helps a lot. So if you don't mind heading over to iTunes and doing that, I'd appreciate that. All right, folks. Thanks again for listening to another episode of the Handgun World Podcast. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. Remember that the loudest sound a shooter hears is a bang when he's expecting a click, or a click when he was expecting a bang. Hey, remember, the music is by Ozark Revival, and you can get a free download of this song just by going to OzarkRevival.com, signing up for their mailing list, and you'll get a free song. You'll get this song here, which is called You Ain't Getting My Guns. I'll talk to you next week. Goodbye. Bye.